Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Prinsen, your host for this weekly conversation about our place in the planet. Have you wondered how Zenith Energy got a foothold in Portland to expand a moribund asphalt terminal into the largest tar sands export terminal on the West Coast? An investigative report released today by the Center for a Sustainable Economy reveals that the financial backers of Global Partners, a major transporter of crude by rail, and Zenith Energy Management, Oregon's largest facilitator of crude oil exports, are heavily invested in Canadian tar sands and Bakken shale oil developments. Today we talk with Daphne Wisham, Mia Reback, and Nick Caleb with the Center for a Sustainable Economy about how these companies and their financiers are active in nurturing political operations to smooth passage of legislation and permits that are facilitating the flow of crude by rail through Portland. Daphne, who just ran in the door, welcome.
Good to be here.
And Mia and Nick, welcome back to Luck is Focus.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This report has just been released, as of midnight last night.
Last night, yeah.
And one of the things that struck me as particularly intriguing was the characters that we see are having a great deal of interest in what's happening here in Portland. So let's first start a little bit by the characters in this report and the kind of alarm bells you should send off. And then I think we need to backtrack a little bit and talk a bit more about what tar sands are for people who've forgotten about that, because we haven't been hearing as much about them recently. So first of all, Daphne, who are the chief characters in your study?
Well, first of all, we're talking about two different corporations. One is Global Partners, which is a major transporter of crude by rail and recently won the approval from the Port of Columbia County, Oregon, to store and transfer a wide range of crude oil products at its Port Westward terminal in Clatskanie. The other one, Zenith Energy Management, that's the topic of the hearing tonight that the City Council is pulling together, is Oregon's newest facilitator of crude oil exports. And this is despite the fact that we've worked very long and hard to put in place restrictions on all new fossil fuel infrastructure. They're planning on expanding an existing terminal that was approved in 2014. In spite of the fact that this terminal, like the rest of the fossil fuel infrastructure, sits right on top an earthquake subduction zone. So that's sort of the broader frame. We're looking at two corporations. Now, the people that are involved in these two corporations, the primary financier of both Zenith and Global Partners operations sites is a man by the name of Richard A. Kane. He's an American billionaire, private equity investor who is very closely aligned with the Koch brothers. You may have heard of the Koch brothers. They're heavily invested in the tar sands. They're also big investors in timber products, Georgia-Pacific and others. Well, Richard Kane is a major Republican Party campaign donor. In fact, he has been a key supporter of President Trump's legal defense fund as he takes on the special counsel and responds to the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian meddling in the 2016 election. So that's Richard Kane. He financed Global Partners' acquisition of strategic sites in North Dakota and Oregon. The other financier is Timothy Geithner. You may recall Timothy Geithner worked as president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank from 2003 to 2009. And then he went on to be appointed U.S. Treasury Secretary under former President Obama from 2009 to 2013. As such, he was a key player in the bailout of a lot of these Wall Street corporations that went belly up when we had the subprime mortgage crisis of 2008. So Geithner, Tim Geithner, who has very clear ties to the Obama administration, and of course Obama famously was an all-of-the-above energy strategy kind of guy. We look back on his time in office perhaps fondly compared to what we have today, but he once bragged that we built enough pipelines to circle the planet and then some. So Geithner is now the director of Warburg Pincus Investment Company, which created Zenith Energy to facilitate the flow of crude to and from Portland. So Warburg Pincus, who are they? They are deeply invested both in the Bakken oil region of North Dakota, as well as in the tar sands region of Canada. And together with global partners, they make a lot of campaign contributions to Democratic candidates at all political levels. And what our report explores is all of these players, but also who are some of the recipients in Oregon campaign finance terms from these corporations. And we look at all of the various politicians on both sides of the aisle that have benefited from their largesse.
Including our governor.
Including our governor.
Well, before we get more into the details of these financiers who, for some reason or other, had their sights on Portland now, Mia, I wanted to step back a little bit and talk a bit about tar sands, because I think a lot of people at this point are familiar with these amazing photographs of these enormous open pit mines that you can see from space, and that a lot of people probably know that tar sands oil extraction is some of the most carbon-intensive processes on the planet. But let's talk more detail about what are tar sands, the oil that comes from tar sands, and how is it different from our traditional oil or the gasoline that we put in our tank, provided you don't drive an electric car?
Yeah, and I think this is a really important point to touch on, which is how tar sands is distinct from conventional crude oil. So there's that Beverly Hillbillies image of you just, you know, tap the ground and this black crude oil bubbles up and it flows very easily. And that's not what tar sands are like at all. It is known as the most environmentally destructive industrial project in the world. As Barbara mentioned, these open pit mines, they have to start by clear cutting the beautiful boreal forest. And then they begin digging with these diggers that are multiple stories high, bigger than any building you've ever seen, to dig up this stuff that is more similar to tar and sand than it would be to a liquid, free-flowing crude oil that you might think of. And so part of what makes tar sand so environmentally destructive is it completely devastates the landscape that it's in. It requires complete transformation of the land. But it's extremely energy intensive and requires all of these toxic additives to be added to create a product that can be loaded onto a train or onto a pipeline and then be refined into something that might resemble gasoline or other products that we're used to dealing with. And in Portland, why this matters is because Zenith is sited in an area that already stores fossil fuels. However, the other facilities at the terminal hub are storing refined petroleum products, gasoline, jet fuel, coming from refineries in Washington State for our local and regional use. And that means we have other local and regional laws that apply to these fuels and that say we're going to transition away from them because of climate change, because of livability, and all these other reasons. But Zenith is coming into the same location and setting up a tar sands transfer and storage terminal. And what that means is they're bringing in unrefined tar sands crude oil, storing it in Portland, and then shipping it on to other stages in the market. So we're stuck as the pass-through home, which, as this report really shows, was, you know, picked by investors, people that are financially invested in tar sands extraction, who then have a financial motive and goal to get that product to market. And so as people throughout the country are doing an amazing job fighting back against new pipelines and other projects, the industry is forced to look for other routes to get their destructive tar sands crude to market. And they are manufacturing this demand from the investment, from the tar sands extraction site, to the midpoint storage terminals, and then creating that buyer at a time when we know we need to be moving away from fossil fuels.
Well, I also want to add, because it's another method of extracting tar sands. It's not as well known. It's called SAGD, which stands for steam-assisted gravity something or other. I don't remember what the D stands for. But it's a little bit like fracking, where they actually do horizontal drilling, and they drill two holes and through two pipes, and through one pipe is they pour steam, which uses, I'm going to make this up, but something like a third of all the natural gas produced in Canada is actually going to the SAGD facilities that mostly are south of Fort McMurray, and most of the open pits are north of Fort McMurray, the city that burned a few years ago because of climate change and all the carbon that region puts into the air. And so the SAGD operation Well, it's underground. You can't really see it, except you can see the seismic lines in the boreal forest when you fly over, because they have to do all this major investigating before they decide where the veins of the bitumen are that they're going to mine. The bitumen is way underground, and the bitumen is this tarry stuff, which, in fact, Andrew Nikiforuk, who wrote the best book on tar sands I know of, calls it like a hockey puck. So it's really, really hard to... So that's why they use a steam. They heat up the bitumen to this intense heat so it would actually flow through the pipe. And so this is even more of an energy-intensive process than the one that we're familiar with. And that stuff, though, when it comes out, they add the diluents in the process, and so it flows like oil when it gets into the pipelines. And that's not what's coming down to Portland right now, but that might be the future, actually. Though I understand, I think, from this report, that the investors are mostly involved with the I think it's called the cold water tar sands pits, which are some of the most productive and one of the oldest ones. So I'm curious about why Portland? The Sightline Institute has been talking a lot about the thin green line. We've been holding it here in Portland. We were really proud of ourselves, and suddenly somebody slipped under the thin green line. So, Nick, what is this thin green line, and how is this a real violation of what we've been trying to do in the region?
The thin green line refers to a strategy that climate and health and safety activists have constructed sort of in resistance to the fossil fuel economy over the last, let's say, 5 to 6 years. What began as anxiety, I guess, over coal exports first coming through the region and people saying, what is this? We're not a coal region. Why do we have coal trains all the time? And sort of out of that consciousness of beginning to map what was going on with the global fossil fuel economy, where North America and the United States are enormous world number one oil and gas producers in the world now by far, and that oil and gas has to go somewhere, and so most of the markets that are growing the fastest are in Asia, Southeast Asia, and so there's a problem for the industry for how to get that stuff, the commodity that they're extracting, to market in order to fuel that energy, and it has to go through the Pacific Northwest for the most part. And so people started to develop a consciousness here that, well, you know, if we wanted to be really impactful on climate, maybe the thing that we could do is try to prevent these terminals from being built in the first place. So there's a climate rationale. Sightline in 2014 estimated that the volume at that time of the 28 fossil fuel terminals that were proposed, were they to be built and operated at full capacity, would be 5 times what could go through the Keystone XL pipeline. And James Hansen and other climate scientists referred to Keystone XL as climate game over if it were ever built. So 5 times climate game over. And so out of that fact, we've had an enormous mobilization in the Pacific Northwest, an extremely successful mobilization in the Pacific Northwest. And none of those terminals that were proposed at that time have been constructed. Some are still at various stages of permitting and many have been denied. So we've had enormous success as a climate movement, health and safety movement, at blocking these projects. And especially those that are moving tar sands, their investors are getting scared and they're trying to find new ways to get their product to market. And so they're, you know, scratching and clawing for anything they can possibly find. And in Portland, this, what formerly was an asphalt terminal, was a place that kind of, they had some permits for development that preceded a lot of the work that happened in Portland when we banned fossil fuel infrastructure and put forward all these resolutions in opposition. And so they've been able to kind of sneak in while nobody was paying attention and kind of, let's say, jerry-rig a project so that they can potentially continue to do this.
And I think it's important to start to break down some of the rhetoric that Zenith Energy themselves are using. And so Nick points out, you know, landlocked fossil fuels in the middle of North America, they need to get it to market, they have to go through West Coast ports. They can't get new facilities permitted. What do? You find an old existing facility. Well, the Department of Environmental Quality referred to this terminal site as a ghost town, and it was run down and not really being used, which is actually the perfect type of facility to eye for a just transition, to say, we have this old industry, it was polluting, we have better alternatives now, let's dismantle it, let's clean it up, let's remediate. And instead, these out-of-state companies come in and say, in 2017, we're going to create a tar sands export terminal. And I think that's bombastic, and we really need to ground in the fact that we have a climate emergency right now. We know we need to be moving away from fossil fuels, and yet billionaires are saying the opposite and saying that Portland instead is going to have a tar sands terminal.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle, and today we're talking with Mia Reback, Daphne Wisham, and Nick Caleb, who are with the Center for Sustainable Economy, about a new report they just released that exposes the financial and political forces behind two companies pushing the flow of crude by rail through Portland. Well, you mentioned, Mia, that this is a moribund ghost facility, actually, and this is the kind that they can slip into. Now, it seems to me that why don't we have protections to protect basically the policy that we set forth a couple years ago with the infrastructure ban for future fossil fuel facilities? Why is there no way to seem to stop this or to prevent these companies from coming in?
So in 2016, the city passed what's called the Fossil Fuel Terminal Zoning Amendments, which were a restriction on new large storage facilities of over 2 million gallons, which was approximately the length of a 1 mile unit oil train, and what are called transloading capacity. So moving fossil fuels from train to ship, for example, using an intermediary. And so that was passed in 2016, and there were immediate legal challenges to it. And ultimately, the city, with some nonprofit interveners, including the Center for Sustainable Economy, prevailed in that lawsuit. And the Oregon Court of Appeals said that it does not violate the dormant constitution of the Commerce, or the dormant Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution, to protect health and safety in your community from the fossil fuel industry. So that was very positive. But along the way, we also had certain land use findings that were invalidated and need to be done again. So that law is technically, until probably this fall, not in place.
But I thought it was going to be in place on July 1st.
Well, the city is setting their schedule for when they want to re-implement this. And of course, we're pushing for faster schedule because we're worried about other terminals potentially siting in that space. But the broader point is that this facility, because of the way that land use law works and how permits can be grandfathered, it wouldn't necessarily have even prevented this anyway because of the nature of the facility and because of the permits being granted in 2014. So we, you know, will argue that, well, I mean, a new facility that's changing its use considerably, it's buying permits from another facility, that they shouldn't just be able to automatically inherit that and start operations. They should have to go through review again. And we're making those arguments still. We'll see where those go. But we don't have a tar sands ban in Portland. We don't have a transloading of tar sands ban or anything like it. And so they really did find this kind of little niche area where exactly the project that they want to do could fit into this ghost terminal, like Mia said.
Wait, but we have a fossil fuel infrastructure ban. So tar sands is a fossil fuel. Why is it not banned?
So it's really this kind of perfect loophole that they found. So the facility had a suite of existing infrastructure that enabled them to begin importing and selling tar sands crude the same month that they bought the terminal. So prior to any new infrastructure being built, Zenith was able to bring in tar sands crude oil trains in December of 2017, early 2018, right when they first bought the terminal, load it onto marine tankers, and sell it on the global market.
Wait, I'm a little confused. How did what was in their permits that allowed them to? This was before the infrastructure ban was in place. Is that it?
So the facility already has connection to the rail line to receive crude oil trains. It already had the rail unloading infrastructure to unload 12 rail cars at a time, or about 20,000 barrels per day. And the facility already had about 1.5 million barrels of storage capacity. So it already had all of the existing infrastructure it needed to begin this operation. However, the limitation on how much it could actually unload, that rail unloading limitation, slowed down their business. It meant it would take them many, many days of work to unload a full unit train. The permits that Nick is talking about, these were old permits filed by a previous company to build additional rail unloading infrastructure.
In 2014, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So they were filed by ARC Logistics in 2014. ARC Logistics never began construction. They did not use these permits. So when Zenith bought the terminal, They bought all of this existing infrastructure, and they bought old permits to expand.
Now, I just wanted to point out that a very similar thing happened with Global Partners in Klatske Nye, where they pulled a fast one only in 2013. They bought a bankrupt ethanol facility, the Columbia Pacific Biorefinery, and quietly and secretly changed its operations to handle crude oil with almost no public notice and no due process. So that permit is, there is going to be a hearing on that coming up, I believe, in early August. So there is an opportunity for people that are concerned about that particular.
Actually, there's a hearing on July 24th. Is that, I'm not sure.
Is that, maybe that's the correct date.
I have it somewhere in my brain, but
Yeah,
it's definitely July 24th. Okay. I think it's in the morning and it's out in Klatske Nye,
right,
wherever they have their hearings in Klatske Nye. Yes. Actually, this reminds me of things that happen in other parts of the Northwest, which we thought couldn't happen here. I just was in Southern Oregon the last few days and talking to people about Jordan Cove and thinking about the way that Jordan Cove started out with these permits to do an import facility and then tried to use the same permits to do export. And it actually didn't work. And that's one reason why they lost their first round with FERC. But that there's this. This is a mindset, and this is this whole set of sort of a game plan that these companies have of trying to go around our laws. And then the other thing that it reminds me of is this LNG tank that's been built in Tacoma without any permits. And that's something that we would have said a year ago, oh, that can't happen in Portland. But obviously, these things are happening here. And I'm wondering, first of all, how your report and sort of drawing out who these people are, the financiers who are behind this, if there's a way that this can kind of accelerate some action on the part of both the community and our leaders to make sure that this stuff isn't going to happen here.
And I think that's definitely a goal, and something that we are looking for is to see more leadership locally from our elected officials and others in positions of decision making to really stop both Zenith and the Global Partners terminals. And I think that it's really important, and what this report really illuminates is that, you know, Portland is being played. We are totally being used by these billionaires for them to make a profit, and that we really need to break down the narrative that Zenith is necessary. We need to break down the narrative that Zenith is part of our community. They are not. These are out of Portland, out of Oregon people.
From Houston,
you know,
right?
You know, these are, you know, the Koch brothers' friends saying, we want to make a buck, and the way to do it is to use Portland for our own gain.
Now, I'm curious, like, why Portland instead of, let's say, Tacoma or Longview or some other place that has also, I'm sure, a lot of moribund facilities?
So the fact that we had this unused, basically vacant storage terminal made it a prime target. Our rail connection and the marine connection, so the Columbia River being there, really is the, you know, perfect set of things to move this product. And at the same time, all of that same infrastructure can be used for renewable energy and for the other things that we need. And so in the same way that the Columbia River will help, you know, transport tar sands to global market, the Columbia River can import wind turbines and play a role to transition to the renewable energy economy that we know we need and want locally.
I just wanted to point out one interesting fact that we explore in the report that you can find on our website, which is sustainable-economy.org, which is when Zenith purchased ARC Logistics, their chief financial advisor was Barclays Bank. Why is that important? Well, it turns out that Tim Geithner, who you will recall as the head of Warburg Pincus,
and former Treasury Secretary,
purchased ARC Logistics. He also was the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And in 2012, he failed to sound an alarm about Barclays' manipulation of the LIBOR benchmark interest rates. In other words, Barclays was apparently profiting from fudging the interest rates. He did not communicate, according to the Washington Post, in key meetings with top regulators that British Bank Barclays had admitted to Fed staffers that it was rigging LIBOR, according to people familiar with the matter. Instead, regulators at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission and the Justice Department worked largely without the Fed's help to build a case against Barclays. Okay, so keep that in mind. Tim Geithner did a big favor to Barclays when he was head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. And now who is helping Tim Geithner purchase ARC Logistics? Barclay Bank.
It's interesting. I think about Tim Geithner when he was being nominated and investigated for being the Secretary of Treasury. It came out that he had not declared all of his income on his income tax. And his excuse was that it was TurboTax's fault. And I think that, to me, that said an awful lot about this guy. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't want him, you know, being in charge of our nation's finances. But I think that there's a kind of a slimy mindset, mm-hmm. and that it permeates both. And we see it. It's not just in the Republican administrations. Also, in Clinton and in Obama, there were some pretty slimy people that were in charge of finances. Now, again, I want to know, how do we use this information to as a hammer or whatever, mm-hmm. a spear to get these companies out of Oregon?
Well, there's a lot of movement. I mean, in Portland in 2014, 2015, we really started what's now kind of become a national movement against fossil fuel infrastructure. And even the code that we passed in 2016, which was done very well by our city staff, by the way, is used as a model for other jurisdictions when they imagine doing something similar. So New York is investigating prohibiting fossil fuel infrastructure at the state level, Minnesota as well. There's a really strong campaign in California to do the same. It's something that in 2014, 15, and 16, when we were talking to the city, MIA especially was raising the alarm around pass-through. It wasn't something that was unanticipated that we didn't see. Really, I think what happened is sort of the political attention of the city to get all of the things done that we asked them to get done was hard at that time. And so there are ideas that we can revisit. I mean, we've been thinking and worrying about this for a long time. So it's not a question of if we can do it. A lot of it is political will. So the city of Portland returning to some of the commitments that it made in 2014, 15, 16, unanimously voted on all the time, and changing the laws over the next year or so here is really important. And then we really need to scale up to the state level, because the city is not the best player to be asserting health and safety authority. It's actually the lowest on the rung of power. We figured out how to do it, and we should do it in absence of anybody else acting. But Governor Kate Brown is another person who needs to be put on the spot a little bit about this. She's been utilizing climate rhetoric like crazy for the last few years.
Kind of like the guy up north.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I mean, like, Inslee's a really interesting comparison, because Inslee recently came out opposed to new fossil fuel infrastructure after years of activists trying to get him in that space. He was good. You know, he wanted to talk about carbon pricing, but really didn't want to talk about fossil fuel infrastructure. Similarly, we've got a governor who talks about climate, talks about, you know, how much he wants to protect young generations and all the rest. And fossil fuel infrastructure is really probably our biggest contribution to global climate change. Jordan Cove facility would be the largest emitter in Oregon history if you account for all of its life cycle emissions. These tar sands facilities at Global Partners and Zenith, if they were to operate in full at capacity all the time, it'd be something like 200,000 barrels a day of tar sands oil being potentially exported. So, I mean, we don't know if that will come to pass, but the potential is enormous. And so closing these loopholes is enormously important. The city needs to take action, and we can push them to take more. And then our state legislature also needs to take action.
Well, if you're just turning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Nick Caleb, Daphne Roshnam, and Mia Reback, who are with the Center for Sustainable Economy. And we're talking about how to stop Zenith Energy, which I understand that people want to change their name to Zenith Crude Oil. But anyway, them and Global Partners, who are in the throes of building these rather massive facilities to export tar sands and Bakken oil through Portland. I actually, when you were talking about needing to go to the state level to stop this kind of infrastructure, what I've been picking up in my work in the last few months is that I didn't realize that Oregon has the weakest laws on the West Coast about energy and at many levels. So I want to talk a little bit about that. You mentioned this. This is referred to in the report, Daphne. What do we have to do on a state level so that we're even on par with Washington State, not to mention California?
Well, I'm going to hand that one over to Nick, but before I do, I just wanted to tag on to your last question, which is what can be done to stop this? I mean, I think one of the key messages that I think we should convey to activists everywhere is that we have been enormously successful in resisting pipelines, tar sands pipelines in particular. And that success has had enormous costs for the corporations that are heavily invested in the tar sands. Now, our next big frontier, unfortunately, is tar sands by rail. Now, that's a lot more complicated, but I, you know, regardless of how complicated it is, I think we should pat ourselves on the back and say, you know, job well done. We've really slowed down the most destructive form of fossil fuel on the planet, a form of fossil fuel that Dr. James Hansen said if we completely exploit would be game over for the planet. So we look forward to working with people all over this country on strategies to stop crude by rail. The one thing that we haven't touched on in the transport of crude by rail is, and this is touched on in our report, is that what is happening is that they're bringing massive crude by truck across the border to North Dakota and then loading it by train. So you can see how we've disrupted their economic development strategy. But it's really striking to see just in the last year or so a huge uptick in crude coming from the tar sands region to North Dakota and then onward from Global Partners facility there in North Dakota by rail to Portland and on to Port Westward.
And I think exactly because of that complicated nature of addressing crude by rail transport, we need action at the local, state, and federal level to really stop this project. And I just want to touch on a little bit more about some local action that can be taken before we move on to talking about the state, because we've spoken a lot about old permits and about permits that Zenith bought. But Zenith is also requesting new permits as well. And so we really need to be towing a strong line and encouraging the city to say no to every ask from Zenith. Every new permit, every extension, every appeal needs to be denied on principle, because we should not be having tar sands in Portland, but also because we don't have the full information about what this facility is doing. They've brought in a lot of different types of crude oil trains. Some of them have toxic inhalation placards, some of them don't. We are seeing that there are a limited number of transportation lines that can bring tar sands out from Canada to Portland, but there still are a few. And we as the public are being left in the dark about what is really happening. And it's going to take a change in laws at the state and the federal level in order to get that full transparency about what is happening. And so Oregon State did recently pass an oil train safety bill. They got it through at the end of this session, but it notably left out an important provision for reporting of where trains are going. So Washington State has a law where the terminals themselves have to report how many and what unit trains are coming to them. We don't have that in Portland. So it's really up to us as independent outside people to do the research to try to figure out what is happening in our city.
Well, actually, I've been getting these emails. I just spotted an oil train out in the gorge. I mean, so it's the train spotters are upon us, but it feels like this is crazy. I mean, this is not something that it should be relying on independent citizens to report when the trains are coming. So I'm wondering if these train spotters, if there's a way, if you are funneling your information into a focused energy hub where it might actually emanate into some new regulations.
And so a lot of the train spotting that has been happening has been community run. And I know that the train spotters are actually planning to do a big launch tonight at the City Council Zenith Forum to really do some education on how other people can get involved. And it absolutely is ridiculous that it's up to residents to snap photos of oil trains, document where they see them, and try to piece together these transportation flows. But in the absence of regulation, that is what's happening. And so we definitely need a change in policy at the state level to have more reporting and more transparency. But we're going to need a deeper change in laws to fully prohibit crude by rail.
Well, it seems like one of the things that Oregon's lacking that California and Washington have is a state Environmental Protection Act, which kind of blew my mind. I mean, I learned that a few years ago. Montana has way better state protections than we have, even Montana. And that's how they stopped the heavy haul trucks from going through up to the tar sands with the mega equipment a few years ago. So it seems like we need that, as well as we need much stronger enforcement of oil by rail shipments and of a lot of basic environmental issues. I mean, I found out that our coastal protections aren't as good as Washington and California.
Yeah, and we just weaken them, too.
And that's why we are, I mean, that's why Jordan Cove is being targeted.
Because, and our forest protections, too.
Right.
It's the worst, even worse than Idaho's.
Yeah, so what do we do about this?
The State Environmental Protection Act piece is interesting, and it's true that the lack of one in Oregon gives us a lack of sort of a central group that can sort of survey the cumulative impacts of different projects. But in Washington, SEPA hasn't stopped LNG terminals from being built, for example. So it's better. It adds a layer of review. But if the substantive standards aren't strong, then it still won't stop these projects. It might slow and delay them, which is an improvement. But ultimately, we are in a stage as a civilization right now where we know that we can't build one more fossil fuel terminal anywhere in the world. If we want to stay beneath 1.5 degrees Celsius warming, we have to cut the spigot off entirely and begin a rapid transition of existing fossil fuel infrastructure toward renewable energy and energy efficiency. And so what we need to have at all levels of government right now is a moratorium on fossil fuel infrastructure across the board, whether that's pipelines, whether that's oil terminal facilities. It gets a little bit complicated in some of the federal laws. For example, the Natural Gas Act allows the federal government a lot with export pipelines, but the state still retains significant control over land use and water.
Which is what we're seeing with Jordan Cove right now.
Exactly.
Unless that Trump comes in before DEQ and the Department of State Lands actually make their final reports, it looks like that itself could stop Jordan Cove from being built.
It could be. And the state is leveraging those laws right now. But again, it's not enough. And it's energy suck for all of us to have to mobilize consistently, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of comments and opposition. And I think all of us who work in this field would rather be using our productive energies toward the transition rather than having to say no all the time. And so policymakers can make substantive changes. They could create climate tests. They can have moratoria on fossil fuel infrastructure. We can have 100% renewable energy transition standards and all the rest. The ideas are not lacking. What's lacking in a lot of ways is the political will. And so what Mia said about, you know, not getting our focus too far away from the local, I think is really important, because we have built a movement locally, and we've gotten unanimity among two different councils that we don't want to have new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city. And so it's just a matter of us using that strong base here. The pace is not what we want it to be, but we still are stronger here than we are anywhere else. And so turning that momentum into the laws that we want to see pass the city, and then using those as models for state legislation, not only in Oregon, but elsewhere.
I just wanted to point out that Global Partners plans to use tanks purchased or leased from Portland General Electric that are at least 45 or 50 years old, dating back to the 1970s. And some of the above ground storage tanks that Zenith is using are more than 70 years old. And right now, there are very few regulations that protect the public from these companies' decisions to use this aging infrastructure. It's one reason why we at the Center for Sustainable Economy have been pushing the city and the county to put in place something we call fossil fuel risk bonds that would put the onus back on the polluter to post a bond equivalent to the worst case disaster scenario as a condition of continued operation in the city of Portland and the county of Multnomah. If we succeed, and we hope we will succeed in getting this in place, that would at least at the county level force the polluter to pay and begin, we hope, the process of either making this infrastructure safer for a 9.0 earthquake, if that's possible, or result in the dismantlement of that infrastructure and a just transition.
I have this image as you're talking about the final hearing for the Portland infrastructure ban. And some students from Sunnyside Environmental School gave this really moving testimony. And then this guy from Kinder Morgan stands up and he says, "I feel like I'm at a barbecue and I'm the meat." And he's got to go on about how what was being proposed at the time was a 10% increase in infrastructure that could be allowed for existing infrastructure. Right. And the students are saying, "No, 10%, no, nothing, no increase at all." So he's saying 10% is nothing. We need at least 30%. Otherwise, it doesn't pencil out for us. And then Amanda Fritz, bless her heart, said, "Well, so 10% is not enough?" And he said, "No, it's not." And she said, "Well, then I guess we shouldn't have any at all." And I keep thinking about this is what we're up against, though. Yeah. And I mean, it's nice when you have 12-year-olds who are, you know, standing up and really speaking the truth. And it's nice to have some people in city council who get it as well. But it seems like there's a lot of forces out there that are really pulling us the other way.
Yeah, and I kind of want to talk about these kind of two different visions and energy models that we're seeing. And so one is the fossil fuel model, where quite literally in the case of Zenith and Global Partners, you have billionaires making decisions about the direction that our city and our energy is going to go in. And they're trying to make decisions as a concentrated group of wealthy individuals who are going to privately benefit, are making decisions to lock us into the fossil fuel industry for decades, committing us to climate chaos. And on the other hand, you have the energy justice, democratic energy vision. And I think the Portland Community Energy Fund is an amazing example where over 60% of the people voted yes for this. The people of Portland have so clearly spoken that we want community-based renewable energy. We want that transition here. And we want our local community to benefit. And we want to see communities of color and low-income communities and women and the people left out of the previous economy benefiting from this transition and from renewable energy. And that's what the people in Portland want. And then we have this small cabal of billionaires who are trying to commit us to a different vision. And so I think we're at a crossroads here, and I think that Zenith really highlights it. And it really is going to come down to everyone, but especially our decision makers, our elected officials, the mayor, need to decide whose side are they on. Are they with the people or are they with the billionaires?
Well, what's happening with city council? I remember being down on the railroad tracks at Zenith when the first time people were getting arrested, and somebody from Joanne Hardesty's office came. I think his name is Derek. And he was basically saying, our hands are tied. We'll be sued for hundreds of millions of dollars. It'll have to come out of the parks budget, which they've already slashed the community centers and pools, so don't give us that. And it was really, really frustrating hearing this guy. I'm thinking, you're from Joanne's office. How can you not be more forceful? So I know that people have been having more conversations with this guy, Derek, and I've been hearing positive things about him, and that's good. But I'm wondering, where are the negotiations with city council right now? We have at least one person who I know where she stands, another person who's been pretty good about this stuff, and then three people that I'm not exactly sure where they're at.
So tonight, the city council is hosting a formal city council forum on Zenith Energy. It's going to be at University of Portland, Buckley Center Auditorium. It starts at 6:30 p.m.
5000 North Willamette Boulevard.
Yes, and doors open at 5:45. And if you want to give public comment, please get there early. So the city council is hosting this public meeting where they plan to hear from the community about our concerns, as well as share some of the things that the city thinks they legally can do to address the facility. And so if people are concerned, if you're concerned and care about this, tonight's hearing is a really, really important moment to go and speak directly to the city council and really make sure that they know that the people of Portland don't want this facility here. And so tonight will also be an opportunity for us to hear from them about the current status of what they think they can do. But we know there are a series of policies the city needs to pass. Nick has already talked about reinstating the fossil fuel terminal zoning code amendments. That was the ordinance that banned new storage tanks. And we know that the city can pass additional policies to start to close some of the loopholes that Zenith has exploited. Those policies will not stop Zenith, but they will stop a future bad project like that from happening. And so that's really important. And as I mentioned, Zenith is still applying for new permits. They're still requesting exemptions and appeals. And so the city can absolutely say no to Zenith. And especially while we're still lacking full disclosure and public information about what we're doing, absolutely the city should be denying every ask from Zenith.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Mia Reback, Daphne Wisham, and Nick Caleb, who are with the Center for a Sustainable Economy. We're talking about how to stop the ongoing and proposed expansion of oil trains through and at tar sands oil trains through Portland at the behest of Zenith Energy, and also another oil train proposal that's in the works at Global Partners out in Clatskanie. Actually, is the Global Partners, they're already shipping oil through there too. Am I right?
It's unclear what's happening
at
present.
That's the biggest problem. Yeah. We don't really know.
We know it's a little bit of what's happened in the past, which there is some of that crude oil export. And then there's a lot of unclarity because of these lack of reporting requirements that Mia was talking about. Nobody actually centrally logs this information outside of these companies. And so we outside of our sort of independent citizen activism, and then also the kind of like broad strokes data reporting that we get every so often, we don't have a full picture.
Now, what's really strange about Port Westward, which is the industrial park port area out near Clatskanie, that recently there was a win, Northwest Innovation Works was trying to build their third proposed methanol refinery, world's largest methanol refinery, at Port Westward, and they lost a zoning battle, basically, and Columbia Riverkeeper and several other groups have been involved in fighting that for several years. So I was sort of in a celebratory mood with Dan Sears, and he said, well, then there's Global Partners. he wasn't too happy.
It's kind of like, it feels sometimes like it's an endless fight of the different things coming, but there is going to be a tipping point with the fossil fuel industry, and we're closely approaching it. There are numerous industry groups that sort of report out on forecasts for gas and oil and all the rest. And it's become increasingly common for them to have sections in their reports that are complaining about activists in the Northwest. We are probably the number one thorn in the side of this industry and have been remarkably successful. And so you can like read these reports and the names of your friends and their organizations are popping up in there. So it's really hard work, but it is effective. And, you know, I think we basically have no choice but to fight this stuff. Like, if we really care about the climate crisis, we just have to dig in and, okay, another one pops up. It's really frustrating. Well, this is our work for our generation. And so I think what we've shown is that there is a role for grassroots politics in changing the global conversation, the local, the state, the regional conversation. And we see the effects at CSE because we track them and we support other groups around the country that want to do similar things to what's happening in Portland. And we watch things, ideas and movements and occupations and all the rest, direct action, grow into bigger campaigns elsewhere. And so I think we might have been in a lull here for the last couple of years after a flurry of activity, but I think we're getting ready for another flurry of big activity in Portland.
One thing that's really interesting about both Global Partners and Zenith is that they have not done the same consistent thing at their terminals since either company began their operations. And to me, that speaks to the vulnerability of their business. And that's also then an opportunity for us as the movement to really start to create those choke points to weaken the industry and really stop these projects. One thing that the report talks about is accountability and how these are not companies that can be trusted. Global Partners has a track record of fines and violations in other places. We can expect that to be repeated. And the Global Partners pulled a bait and switch when they first bought into the terminal. It was built with renewable energy subsidies, operated as an ethanol facility for 1 week before becoming a crude oil terminal. And so we already know that these companies can't be trusted.
I just wanted to point out also that, you know, this is a case study in why restricting campaign finance laws are absolutely critical in the state of Oregon. You may recall the series Polluted by Money that came out in the Oregonian. And if you didn't read it, I think it's important to read that piece because it pointed out that Oregon has some of the weakest campaign finance laws in the country. imposing no limits whatsoever on corporate and individual donations to candidates. And it's one of five states in the country that are that permissive. What's also important to point out is that these donations are going to Democrats and Republicans. In fact, Global Partners donated $40,000 to Governor Kate Brown between 2016 and 2018. It donated $25,000 to the Democratic Party of Oregon in 2016. We see a list of everyone from Betsy Johnston to Future PAC to Val Hoyle, Kattie McEwen, Arnie Roblin, Chris Iverson, Port of Columbia County Commissioner, the Senate Democratic Leadership Fund. All of these are getting donations from Global Partners, which has, as we've pointed out earlier in the show, very close connections to the Legal Defense Fund for Donald Trump.
I'm going to interject, but Betsy Johnson also voted, well, would have voted against HB 2020. She's not our friend.
Yeah, yes. She tried to intervene, actually, and give even more handouts to the gas industry at the last second.
Right.
And Peter Courtney removed her from committee and then added timber industry exemptions instead.
But it's one reason why, is one reason why we, and there actually are two organizations represented here, the Center for Sustainable Economy and the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network that MIA works for, which is our 501c4, we have been working with groups across the United States on getting elected officials to take the no fossil fuel money pledge for this very reason. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you're getting dirty money that is coming at the cost of our health and safety right here in our backyards, in our neighborhoods. And we need to make sure that our elected officials say no to all new fossil fuel money coming into their campaigns. They can find out more at our website, scene.org.
Actually, it's interesting with Jay Inslee. He was receiving a lot of money from Puget Sound Energy for years and years and years. But when he made all his great green remarks back on May 8th, one of the things he did was to swore off any future fossil fuel funding of his campaigns. And hopefully he'll stick by it, unlike Beto O'Rourke.
Yeah, and quite a few other presidential candidates have also taken the no fossil fuel money pledge.
I want to get back to maybe a bit of hope, but you keep talking about this pipeline, Mia, and I think of you, I think of the Pembina pipeline that was supposed to go from, you were involved with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stopping Pembina in Portland back in 2014, I think. And that was a 3-mile pipeline or something, a 24-foot pipeline?
No, I think it was like a 700-foot pipeline. And so for listeners who might not be familiar, Pembina was a Canadian propane company that wanted to build a propane export terminal at the Port of Portland.
They're behind you. They bought Jordan Cove.
Jordan Cove now.
Yeah. And Pembina famously said, if Portland doesn't want us, we won't come. And we showed them that we did not want them here. But because Pembina was going to be leasing land from the Port of Portland, there actually wasn't any regulatory hook, or so we thought, until Pembina put in a permit to build a 700-foot pipeline to connect the storage tanks to their dock. That was going to go through an environmental overlay zone, and so it opened up public hearings, and that gave us an opportunity to stop and deny the project. Zenith is a slightly different situation because Zenith currently has all of the infrastructure they need because they use their next door neighbor Chevron's pipe to connect their terminal to a dock. So Zenith actually is working with their neighbors to cobble together the marine transloading component of that facility. So Zenith can, without any expansion, continue to operate. However, Portland Maps, which is a great website that lists all proposed permits for every address in the city, is currently listing a pipeline that Zenith is proposing that they have not yet had any public comment for, but that could be upcoming. And this pipeline is not listed as a crude oil pipeline. However, we are concerned that this pipeline would carry the diluents and additives that they need to have a viable tar sands operation. And so this is brand new. We just learned about it last week. We're still doing our research as a community, as organizers. But that is a potential hook that might be present. And that's why it's so important that we deny every single thing that Zenith is asking for, because we cannot trust them. So a pipeline might not be listed as a crude oil pipeline, but it still could be integral to the crude oil operation.
Well, that's the way they've been operating in Jordan Cove and in Tacoma. I mean, they say it's one thing, it is another thing. So that's, we really have to watch out for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for, we had a meeting with city officials, I don't know, what, 3 months ago, and it was really interesting to see the way that they think about these projects versus how activists think about projects. And so, you know, they just take everything at face value. Well, this is what it says on paper, and here's what the engineering requirements are, and they don't read further into this sometimes. And what we need are... I don't know. I can't say this politely, but people need to stop being suckers, right? Like, if you're going to allow infrastructure to be built that's materially supporting a fossil fuel terminal, that's fossil fuel infrastructure. And that needs to be the way that we think about these projects, not allowing expansion or sort of little by little, or not allowing the additives and diluents to come over here and here and here. Our job is to put a cap on what's happening right now and then start moving away from this as fast as possible. And anything that runs counter to that shouldn't be allowed.
Well, in the last few moments we have, I actually want to just spend a bit of a moment thanking Mia. This is Mia Rebeck's last stand on KBOO for a while. She's about to go to New Haven and study at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. And so I just want to thank you, Mia, for all the amazing work that you've been doing for many years. And we've been really glad to have you here. You've been a wonderful guest on Locus Focus. You've explained many things to the audience. Every time you're on the show, people give me a lot of good feedback. So, and I hope you come back after your studies.
Yes, and thank you so much. It's really, really sad to be leaving Portland to go to graduate school, and yet I know that with climate change as something that we'll be fighting for my entire lifetime, it's an important thing, and I know that I'm so grateful and appreciative of the amazing climate community here in Portland and of all the great work everyone's going to continue to do. And just want to plug some of my favorite organizations really quick, including the Center for Sustainable Economy and the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, but also our close partners that we've been working with on all of these campaigns, 350 PDX, Columbia Riverkeeper, Portland Audubon, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, Friends of the Columbia Gorge. We and other partners are this powerful coalition of community groups, environmental groups, social justice activists that are uniting to protect the climate and to stop fossil fuels.
And so, the Oregon Just Transition Alliance.
Yes. And so one last thing is, what should people do tonight?
Yeah. So everyone, please come out to University of Portland, Buckley Center Auditorium. Get there at 5:45 when doors open. The forum is going to start formally at 6:30 p.m. Come and tell the city council to do everything in their power to stop Zenith. And if the city council thinks their hands are tied, ask them to change the laws and create new opportunities to stop this dirty, destructive project.
And wear red.
And wear red.
And if I can just make a plug for our activist network, which is SEEN.org, SEEN.org, please sign up, become an activist, and we'll keep you posted on all things global partners, all things Zenith, and also taking on the timber industry.
Well, after the show is over, I'm going to get from Daphne the URL to get to the report, and I'll post it on Locus Focus website. We actually have information that you need for the meeting tonight and a link to join on a Facebook event. So I want to thank everybody for joining me today. Thank you, Mia Rebeck, Daphne Wisham, and Nick Caleb. It's always great to have you on Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having us.
And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends and family to hear this, you can listen to the show online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of your favorite KBOO public affairs programming, just go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk with some folks who are trying to save a grove of trees in Westmoreland. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. Thanks for listening.